I'll introduce myself briefly. I'm Richard Gray. I lead the Health Services and Population Research Centre at HMC, and one of the things that I've been trying to do is to organise some seminars and workshops that address some of the kind of barriers and roadblocks to building research capacity in HMC. One of those, I think, is probably around getting published. So how do I get published? So a colleague and friend of mine from the UK, Roger Watson, has kindly agreed to come over and talk about his tips on successful publishing. Roger's kind of credentials for giving this talk are that he is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, which is probably one of the leading journals in the field of nursing internationally. And he's also the editor of Open Nursing, and perhaps more importantly, the professor of nursing at the University of Hull. But I'm going to hand over to Roger, who's going to talk for about 45 minutes, and then hopefully the opportunity for some questions at the end of that. Roger.
Thank you very much, Richard. Okay, this morning, can you hear me? Yeah? Good. Yes, if we could leave questions until the end. I like to interact, but I think if we leave them until the end, we'll get through, we'll make sure we get through the material, and then we can have a discussion. And I know 3 o'clock's home time, it's my home time too, so we'll finish as near to 3 o'clock as we possibly can. Thanks, Richard, for the generous introduction. I can never hear often enough that the Journal of Advanced Nursing is one of the top journals. It's up there, and it's actually Nursing, oh, this is not on. Nursing Open. Open Nursing is a different journal. Okay, this is Nursing Open. So apart from that, it was 100% accurate. So thanks very much. Well, tips for successful publishing begin with successful writing. And I'm going to talk a little bit about actual techniques for writing and then get on to some of the things that we need to address in terms of publishing. And I've had a couple of workshops already, and some people will recognise some of the slides because I've used them already in those, but there's a lot of different material here as well. And all the slides have been given to Neera, who will forward them out to people who've attended. So you can take photographs if you want, but you don't have to note everything down. I won't be stopping for photographs as we're going through, because you can publish slides, and there's no copyright on them. You can use them and do whatever you like with them. So whenever we sit down to start writing, we can't do it. It's a difficult thing to do. It's an unnatural thing to do. Everybody finds it difficult, and nobody finds it more difficult than me. And we do all sorts of things like rearranging the workspace, going on Twitter, social media, getting everything right, you know. But eventually we've got to get down and do some writing. What I want to talk about for the first maybe 10, 15 minutes or so is actual methods for getting writing, because there's no point in talking about tips for getting published or getting published more frequently if you can't get some writing done. So really, I think it's a matter of overcoming barriers, and someone who I don't think is present today, I won't name her, but very usefully asked me a question on Sunday when I gave my first tutorial session, asked me about something called stage fright. How do you overcome the stage fright of writing? Because ultimately you've got to show it to people, and that's one of the barriers that people have to writing. They don't want to share it, they don't want to show it to people. However, everybody's got barriers, and I'm going to cite various people from different sources. It doesn't really matter what the sources are, but a lot of the ones are aphorisms that are not mine. But Dale Salwak points out that whatever piece of writing you see, whatever it is, an article, a newspaper piece, a blog or whatever, somebody's taken time and overcome the barriers to writing. And those barriers are the same for most people. And the main barrier to writing, of course, is time. We just can't find time to do it. Nobody's going to give you time. Everybody wants you to publish. I know the Hamad Medical Corporation wants people to publish, but I'm very doubtful if anybody's going to come along and say to you, take a week off or even a day off or even an hour off to do it. You've got to work it into what you do. And I've got some ideas for how people can work it in and make effective use of their time. Again, some of you will have some of these ideas already. I haven't gone through all of them with you. And one of your colleagues raised with a group yesterday that his approach to being a writer is to read a lot, and I think that's right. To be a writer, you have to read a lot, and you also have to write a lot. There's absolutely no shortcut to it. I can't offer any shortcuts, panaceas, or any easy way to write. To write, you have to actually sit down and write. Not making it sound very attractive, I know, but it's finding, again, quality times to do this and not making it become a job that just gets out of hand. We all tend to think of the end product, but it's much better to think of steps along the way, and also it helps you to write much, much better. So there's somebody reading and somebody writing, just in case you didn't know what it looked like. Norman Mailer, a famous American author, said that he learned to write by writing. So what he means is you won't learn to write by sitting or standing or whatever, discussing things with me. Writing is the best way to learn to write. And he says professionalism, and I really like this saying, professionalism comes from being able to write on a bad day. Now, I see clinicians and teachers and educators here, and you've all got to come in and do your lectures or your clinics or whatever, and it doesn't really matter what sort of mood you are when you leave the house in the morning, whether you've had an argument with your wife or your husband or the children have been bad, or you stubbed your toe on the step or you've got a headache, you're still got to go and do your work unless you're really ill. But for some reason, we all use these as excuses not to write. We all put writing at the end of the list of things that we want to do, and we don't see it as part of what we're doing. And I think that professionalism, by which I mean being professional, writing regularly, getting yourself published, is part of your job, comes from being able to do it, whether you're feeling in a good mood or a bad mood, and whether you feel like writing or not, and working it in regularly into your working schedule. And again, I'll come back to ways to do that. And none of my own words yet, all words from other people. Lord Beaverbrook, newspaper editor, and I remember using this quote the last time I was here about a year ago, he was asked by a journalist, how do you become a writer, how do you become a journalist? And Lord Beaverbrook said, application. And he said, great, that's good. The journalist went off, came back a couple of weeks later and said, I actually don't know what you mean. And what Lord Beaverbrook said is, apply your seat of your pants to the seat of a chair and don't get up until you've written something. So you do have to set time aside to do this. You do have to sit down and write. It simply won't happen any other way. So this part of the body here is very important and the seat's very important. Join them together. Or, what one of my very good colleagues does, don't sit down and write. Raise your computer up to the level where you can stand and write. That's effective too. You know what I mean. You've got to apply yourself to it and do it or something. And, you know, you've got to learn to write wherever you are. There's somebody sitting under a tree by a lake or a loch where I come from writing. I think you've got to learn to write in different places. We all tend to think of the favourite place we've got to write, usually at our offices. PhD students are really bad for this. They tend to develop favourite places to write. And I think these days we mustn't do that. We must learn to write in different places, on different media, and learn how to fuse it all together, save it, store it, and make the best use of all the time that we've got. And learn to write anywhere, at any time. If I go away with colleagues overseas, I've got different kinds of colleagues with whom I go. I've got the ones like me that get to the airport lounge and open up their laptops and immediately they're working, they're doing their emails and working. I've got the other ones who come along and I'm sitting hammering away at my laptop and they're just sitting, you know, having a cup of coffee and looking out the window and say, what are you doing? Well, we're away from the department, we don't need to. I said, no, you're still being paid, you know. So, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, learn to write wherever you are. In the office, by all means, and learning to write in the office might involve getting in half an hour earlier in the morning, cutting your lunch break by half an hour, staying till 3:30 instead of going at 3, or maybe finding, instead of wandering about the corridor looking for somebody to talk to, just sitting down and doing a short piece of writing. It doesn't have to be a long time. So the office is clearly one place. Writing at home, it may well interfere with your personal life, writing, if you're going to take it seriously. Writing, certainly for academics, and because of the push here, I'm sure it counts towards promotions and salaries and things like that. You're getting something out of it. You've got to put something into it. But again, I'm not saying you've got to sit at home and write all the time, all weekend, all night. Trains, planes, hotels, they're great places to write, especially if you're by yourself and you've got Wi-Fi in your computer. So never go away without your computer or your iPad or your iPhone. You can write in all of them. Doesn't matter what format. Don't say, well, I don't have a Word package on my iPad. Write it in an email and email it to yourself. That's what somebody who said they did yesterday, and then paste it into a document. So I don't like to hear any excuses about people saying, I can't write here, I can't write there, I haven't got time. We've all got times when we can write little bits. Keep a notebook. You know, I don't advise writing by hand, but I do advise keeping a notebook. I'm a copious note taker, or have a notebook I've got with me, but on my iPhone I've got an errands thing. Take a note there, so that the ideas you have don't get lost. Here's somebody in the shower keeping notes. That's maybe a little bit extreme, but say keep a notebook. So, if you want to be a writer, and you want to write regularly, but bad pedagogy for the teachers present to teach from negatives, but here are some don'ts before I get on to the do's. One of the things you mustn't do if you're going to write a lot is don't think about it, okay? People say, well, what do you mean by that? What I mean by don't think about it is don't think about it. Don't sit around thinking about what you're going to write. Don't sit about thinking, I wish I could write or I wish I was writing. Do some writing. Thinking about writing is just procrastination. And the longer you think about it, the less writing you'll do. And those of you with a psychological or psychiatric background, I don't mean a personal history of mental illness, I mean those of you with training in these fields, will know that you can only hold a certain number of thoughts in your head at any one time. And the best way to get more thoughts into your head is to put them down on paper and then the other ones come. You can only hold about 5 to 8 thoughts in your head. And many people sit down, and I used to do this, and think, I'll plan out what I'm going to write. But by the time you've got to plan out what I'm going to write, that's 7 of your 8 words gone. And you just keep those words just keep banging around in your head. Unless you're special with an eidetic memory. But otherwise, the best thing is to write. Don't think about it. Don't tell anyone about it. That's another good tip, I think. Two things with telling people about your writing is, let's imagine I work for Richard, perish the thoughts, or Richard works for me. Anyway, one of us works for the other one, and I go to Richard and tell him I'm going to write something. What am I doing? I'm putting it off. I'm not doing it. What I should be going is doing what colleagues in the front row here did today, is showing me something they've written, and then we can work from that. So don't go telling people that you're going to write stuff, because you tend to be putting it off. The other reason is if I tell Richard I'm going to write something, he's going to ask me the next day, have I written it? So I've seen them doing that here with colleagues, and the pressure then is on. Don't tell people. Take the pressure off yourself. Hide yourself away for short periods. Build up something, write it, then give it to somebody. Okay? Don't wait for inspiration. Okay? That never ever comes. Writing doesn't come from inspiration. Writing comes from actually doing it. Perspiration, if you like. Waiting for inspiration is a little bit like thinking about it, waiting for ideas to come through. I have no hoot what religious or spiritual background you come from. Your God, Allah, my God, not interested in your writing. You have to take responsibility yourself, okay? It won't happen magically. So don't wait for inspiration. And to be honest, for the kind of writing that we do, which is scientific writing essentially, you don't need inspiration. What you need are results and data. And ideas which you can get from discussing with people. And, you know, like the Nike sign, just do it. I know that's a little bit trite, but anyway, I think you've just got to do it. So how do you do it? Well, put pen to paper, delay no more is one of the things I would say. I must ask at this point, does anyone in the audience speak Cantonese? That's a relief. Okay, I'll tell Richard why afterwards. Okay, but delay no more is very good word in Cantonese, but it just happens to be a slogan that's used by a particular shop there. But I really, you know, get some writing done. Get a notebook, get some writing done. Just do it. Remember, that is no use. You can edit a bad page of writing, but you can't edit a blank page. So don't sit around looking at a blank page of a computer or a blank piece of paper. Try and put something down on it. And it honestly doesn't matter what you put down, as long as it's relevant to what you're doing. What you're doing is getting the ideas out of your head and you're getting started. And again, unless you get to that stage, you're never going to have anything to submit to a journal. The only inspiration that you need is to pull the chair up to the desk. That's the most inspiring thing you can do, or just turn on your computer or any of the things that would get you writing. That's the inspiration that you need. Then don't wait for something to fall into your head from on high. Get doing it. This is a bad way to write, okay? Again, I think I mentioned this to some of your colleagues yesterday. This is a real photograph. Well, obviously it's a real photograph. This is from a colleague of mine from Hull, now left Hull, but we're still working together on a paper, which is still being written. And this was her in the process of writing it at her desk. Biscuits, things to grip her hair back with, iPhone, headphones, everything she needs, something to change the television or the music station. and surrounded by every paper that she's read on the subject. And I would really strongly advise you not to write in this way, or virtually on a screen with all the PDFs open, because it stops you from writing. I think the best thing is to do is to read all that you need to read, by all means. You know, do your research and inverted commas on it. Shelve it all and sit down and write what you want to write. And the best place to do that is as far away from this as possible. Because all you do when you're surrounded by PDFs and information and websites is you say, I've read it, so I'm damn well going to get it referenced in what I'm writing. You know, you sort of chisel it into the writing. Don't do that. Just write and then find the bits of information that you need to support what you're going to say. Unless you're doing a systematic review or a PhD thesis, you don't need to cite every single piece of literature that you've read or that's in the field. It completely stops the flow of writing. And I know that because I used to write like that and I stopped doing it. And I found that I stopped writing like that because I travel a lot and I used to carry two bags with me, one full of PDFs of papers I was going to read and write. And I just stopped doing it and it didn't inhibit my writing in this. Dale Salwak, this is quoting him again, on the point of inspiration, says, instead of planning or talking about your plan, this is just the things I've said already, but in different words, just get on with it, no matter how confusing it sounds. The initial drafts that you're going to do, you know, the initial draft of any piece of writing is usually embarrassingly bad, including mine, but the thing is, nobody's going to read that. Get it down, you don't have to show it to anybody. You know, sort it out later, but get it down before you forget what you're going to say. Do the first draft before you do any research. By this he means don't sit down surrounded by papers doing, you know, determined to get every bit of knowledge into it. Write what you think is the structure for what you're going to write, fill in the details later. And then actually, this is very true, we usually don't know what we're going to write until we've actually started writing it. And I've proven that to myself time and again. I don't know why I say yes to all these things, but I do a monthly blog for Sigma Theta Tau, I do one for a nursing home company in the UK. I do the blog for our faculty, and sometimes a little bit of pressure comes up on my to-do list. I've got to do this. I just do it then, and I actually don't know what I'm going to write. I write the Sigma Theta Tau blog about my travels, so I know I'll write something about Italy last week and Qatar this week. But that's the starting point. But once you start writing, it actually comes. It needs to be edited and all the rest of it. You get better at it. But I really mean, don't try to think what the end product's going to be like. Start writing and see where you get. And if you say, well, we've got a title and an abstract, adjust them. Go back and adjust them to fit what you've written. So, I did mention the four rules of writing to some of you a couple of days ago, or maybe it was yesterday. But I only covered a couple of them. So I'm going to go through them all here very, very quickly. These are the four rules, my four rules anyway. Somewhat arrogantly, my four rules. There are other people might disagree. But reading the guidelines, this is really how to get published. Read the guidelines. I've said that to every single person I've met today and every group I've met, and I think I said it on Sunday morning when I gave a lecture then. Set realistic targets and count words. Seek criticism. By criticism, that caused a furore the last time I was in Qatar. By criticism, I mean comment on what you're doing, positive or negative criticism, but let somebody else see it. And the most important of the four rules has nothing to do with writing, it's to do with attitude. Treat a rejection as the beginning of the next submission. So every time you get rejected, and I get rejected, Richard gets rejected, you will get rejected, that's a sign of somebody who's active in writing. Far better to be somebody who's been rejected than never to have submitted something. So when you get rejected, just say, obviously, that journals and its reviewers and the editors are a complete bunch of fools. They don't realise how brilliant my work is. I'm going to send it somewhere else. And always have an insurance policy or a safety net. And have an idea of a range of journals up and down the way in terms of impact, across the way in terms of speciality and things. Didn't get in there, I'll go there or I'll move there. So have a plan in mind. So don't be cowed by rejection. I won't say any more about that just now. You might want to ask me about rejection later, and I'm going to finish off by talking about dealing with reviewers' comments, which is relevant to that as well. So reading the guidelines, I'm using my own journal webpage, an old version thereof, but read the guidelines, okay? On the landing page for every journal's electronic these days, all of the submissions are online. and on the landing page, if it's a good journal, there should be author guidelines. I was saying to Richard today, I don't know why Wiley choose to bury them away down there. I think they should be there in massive letters, because this is the biggest problem for an editor-in-chief. I before we came across, I was drinking coffee in Richard's office and looking at my editor's page for the journal editor-in-chief page. There were 10 papers in exactly. I think I sent two to other journals or suggested. Two of them still got to be done, and two of them were rejected because when I opened them up, they simply didn't follow the guidance. And I checked the main manuscript, they hadn't followed the guidance. That's it. End of story. We haven't got time to deal with them beyond that. So the first thing to getting published is read the guidance. What does the guidance tell you? It tells you all sorts of things, but the superficial things that we can check very quickly, nothing to do with the science at all, are the length of the paper. If it states it's going to be 5,000 words, don't make it 6,000 or 5,500, make it 5,000 words. There's nothing that can't be edited, in my view. What the layout should be, we still like to see it looking nice and neat. Don't use size 7 font, single-spaced, that kind of thing, or any fancy fonts or squiggly. Use Arial, or preferably Times Roman, size 12, double-spaced, 250 words per page, 25 pages for a 5,000-word article. That's how sad I am. I know these things, okay? We can tell very quickly if it's not the right length. We can count the words. And the layout has got to look neat and tidy. It's got to look like you've loved this piece of work and cared for it, not thrown it together like the, we say, dog's breakfast in the UK, like a mess. Get the organisation right. I've got a whole hour's session on organising a paper. You're not going to get it here, obviously, but what are the headings and subheadings that we suggest you use? If you can't find them in the guidance, the easiest thing to do is find a copy of the journal, recent one, and look at how articles are organised. So somebody who doesn't organise the paper properly, hasn't read the guidelines, and hasn't read a paper in the journal, why should we be interested? We want people to really be targeting the paper to the journal. Referencing system may sound silly and easy to get right, especially with EndNote, RefMan, and these online reference manager systems. But people still get it wrong. We use Harvard. If it's Vancouver, that's an obvious sign they haven't read the journal. Or the other way around for whatever journal it is. And I could go down into the basement with a list of things, Consort guidelines, Prisma guidelines, all the standard guidelines for presenting different kinds of work. We don't have time today. But read the guidance and see how you're supposed to present particular kinds of papers. So that's the first rule of writing. Read the guidelines. Setting targets. Everybody who's a good writer does this. And it was a revelation to me when I heard it from a fellow editor called Rob Newell, I'm sure that Richard knows. And I never thought about it before. And this is something I learned, and I started doing it and improved my writing greatly. Try to write a specific number of words every day, or if you can't write every day, which I know is quite difficult for people, every time you sit down to write, or within the period that you're going to write, try and write a specific number of words, and don't stop until you've achieved it. So my target every time I sit down to write is 500 words. Every time I sit, 2 pages of A4, double space, size 12, Roman, plank, Roman font. Okay, so that's my target. And count the words. It's easy to do. When you've reached your target, you must stop. Don't try and go beyond it. It's like a runner. I like running, and I've done it. Well, my wife's a much better runner than I was. First time she did the London Marathon, at the end of it, she thought, I felt so great I could do it again. But of course she couldn't, she could hardly walk. And it's the same with writing. Don't go beyond it, because you'll get disappointed you haven't gone beyond it. All the ideas that are in your head, put them down as bullet points, and put them down wherever you want within the paper, and then you can pick those up the next time you start writing. I remember saying this to a few of you yesterday. And that helps to keep your flow going. Don't stop like that. Have some more ideas to pick up next time you do it. Save it, back it up, don't lose it. Another trick which I've learned over the years and tell my PhD students when they're sitting looking forlornly at the computer screen not knowing what to do next, and they don't know how to start an article, I say, well, create a file, put in a title, don't even give it a title, put title, page break, abstract, page break, introduction, page break, background, page break, methods page break, you've got the idea, results page break, conclusions, discussion conclusions, references, all with page breaks, and I said you've gone from a blank page to something like 20 words, and save the file, give it a name that makes sense, my latest paper, save it, don't go back to it that day, you've done the first step. Next time you come to writing in the paper, you've got a file already with all the headings and, if necessary, subheadings. Whatever ideas come into your head, write them wherever you want them. You don't necessarily have to start at the beginning, as I'll say near the end of the presentation. So stop. So, again, from the Climb Higher, set daily targets and give you rewards. Give yourself rewards when you finish. My reward is stopping, usually, and getting up and looking out the window or putting on the radio or something like that. But, do something else. Don't sit there and either gloat about it or, if you please, don't sit there and look. Don't edit it. Just save it, close it. Get a whole draft finished of the paper before you start editing. Write, don't edit. So give yourself a reward and treat it like a job. This is what I'm trying to say. You can do this in half an hour very easily. Your target for somebody who's using English as a second language may be 250 words. Doesn't matter, whatever your target is. But, you know, work it into your job. Say, right, I've got half an hour before lunch and I'm not actually doing anything. I'll write something. And it's done and out of the way. And then you can come back the next day with some pride that you've done it and carry on. Or later on in the day, if necessary. But don't try to sit down and write 5,000 words. Those of you who work for Richard, don't go and ask him for a week off to write, because weeks off, days off, months off to write, in my view, just never work. Short quality times are by far the most effective way to do it, because you can't write for more than an hour anyway. It's just too much work. So that's the second rule. Set targets, count words, and take that very seriously. The third rule is seeking criticism. To be a great writer, get a great critic. And again, talked about this to some of you yesterday morning, I think. Get people who will do this kind of thing. They'll point out the mistakes. You know, not the people who will give you general advice, the people who will give you specific advice. So find a critical friend. Don't find this sort of person, because that's no good, okay? We've all got those people in our departments. I work with them. I hope I'm not one of them, and I've worked with people like that. Every time you give them something to write, they just say, that's rubbish, hopeless, you know, what were you thinking of? And that's not encouraging. So don't get people who shout at you like that. That's no use either, the sort of person who tells you every time, that's fantastic, you know, well done, great. Because your writing isn't great. Your writing can always be improved. So find the sort of person in the middle, like this, who's been up the mountain, and can actually help you to get there themselves. There's an awful lot of people like Richard and I, but not Richard and I, and maybe others present, who get up the mountain and then they just kick the ladder over so nobody else can get up. Not those people, okay? People who are willing to give you a hand. So that was the third of the four rules. The fourth one, treat a rejection as the beginning of the next submission, okay? Just think, where's it going next? If you get comments from the editors or the reviewers, take them into account. They always help and get it done. Tables and figures. Okay, I'm dotting about a few random things now that will help you to get published. Tables and figures are very important. See how others present them. Richard and I were working with one of your colleagues on a table today. You know, it's very important. I think, if I don't mind Richard, if you say you're obsessed with tables, you know, but they've got to be right. They've got to be informative with as much information as possible and not too cluttered. So if you don't know how to do it, look at an issue of a journal. How do they present tables? Don't use raw statistical outputs. Stata, SPSS, R, they're useless. You've got to re-tabulate them because they're no use raw. Be parsimonious, get as much information into as small a space as you possibly can. Spend some time. Don't dash a table together and think, well, that's it. You know, think, is that really going to be informative? Leave it for a while, come back to it, show it to somebody. Can you make the sense out of this? And can you append? If there's too much material, can you just stick it somewhere else? Put it online. Don't put it in the table. That's another way to get the information available, make the information available, but not to clutter up the table, the paper with it. So that's hopeless. I mean, that's, don't produce tables like that for, it's actually a real table, but you wouldn't produce something like that for a journal. It's just far too complicated. That's pretty useless as well. And the real tables, if you spend long enough looking at that, you can get the information out of it. I'm not comparing like with like necessarily, I'm just giving examples. But this one here, for example, showed it to some of you yesterday, is absolutely, it's ideal. I don't know anything about the subject, and I can tell exactly what the results are just by looking at them. Don't worry about the substance of it. It's got a very clear title. It's got a title. It's got a subtitle which tells you what these pieces mean. It's years, percentages, those in favour, those opposed, those don't know, those are the demographics. You get it in a glance. Brilliant table. Try and make your tables like that. You may have more options. You can make it bigger. You may have more. You can make it wider. But that's a really excellent example of a table. Photographs? Okay, I think back to the writing technique, I'm just jumping about a little bit, but the order of writing, this was supposed to move the slide, for some reason the graphics aren't working, it's gone to the end of the graphics setting, but basically don't start at the beginning. Okay, I should have said that earlier. Don't necessarily start at the beginning. Again, I feel feeling very hard on my PhD students, but that's the big fault of the PhD students, spending 3 years doing a study and then sitting down to write it. You know, and say, well, why haven't you written the results so far? What about the methods? You could have had them written while you were going along. So don't start at the introduction and work your way through to the study of the back. You know, I think the best way to write up a study is to write up, the study means the methods, design and methods. Write what you know you're going to do even before you've done it, and that's very good practice. And in these days, you can actually publish that as a protocol. So get the study out of the way right at the beginning. Those of you who are doing traditional sort of PhDs, you should be doing this anyway, because you've got to present the methods to get a place in a PhD program and to get upgraded halfway through it. So you've got the study, keep it, don't throw it away. Then the next thing you're going to get are the results. So make sure that you get the results written up fully and as clearly as you possibly can, especially for quantitative results. Get the tables done, printed and out in front of you. And then you can build the rest of the paper around it. Now, I'm not saying that you wait until 3 years' time to start putting an abstract or an introduction together, but you wouldn't finalise them until you've written all the rest. People think the introduction is the beginning. It's only the beginning of what you're reading. It's not the beginning of what you're writing, because you don't know what you're going to introduce until you've written it, okay? So it's all back to front. So it's another hint to get going. Don't get stuck on the introduction or you'll be there forever. Lengths of sections of a research paper. Here's another thing that's this is only a suggestion. Please don't leave the lecture hall saying, Roger Watson said you've got this many words. But this is a suggestion for the typical 5,000 word paper, and it's good to get a reasonable distribution between them. So I would say you've got 500 words or so for your introduction, and maybe 1,000 for the background. Introduction and background, subtly different in my view. Some journals ask only for an introduction, some only ask for background. But you've got to have a section at the beginning which puts the thing in context, and a section which says what's known about this field already. That's a reasonable distribution if you're going to fill the 5,000 words. Your methods, unless they're exceedingly complicated, should only take about 500 words in my view. One way to shorten your methods, or the study, as I call it here, is to do a protocol and refer to it and summarise it in the paper. Results, get the results done as quickly as possible. You want to get them done as precisely as possible, get as much into tables as you can, being sensible, and that's what people will look at. They want to see what the results. Don't bury them away in a lot of writing. A couple of thousand words on the discussion, and then maybe 500 words on the conclusion. Now, that may seem a lot, it may seem too little. All I'm saying is that if you find that you've got to write 3,000 words for your discussion because your work is so seminal and important, you want to tell the world about it, what you've got to work out is you've got to make compromises elsewhere. Simple as that, you know. So you've got to rob bits from other places. And if you're working as a team of writers, which is, I see a lot of that going on here, which is entirely laudable, you've got to give somebody who's doing a sort of target. You know, if you're doing the introduction, you're doing the discussion, you know, write 1,000 words, give us 1,000 words, and then we'll work about from that, see how the rest of it goes. And that should add up to 5,000 words nicely. Never work with children, animals, or sums on the PowerPoints, but I've checked that one. However, don't feel obliged to fill the 5,000 words of any, or 3,000, or 7,000, whatever the target. Don't feel obliged. Editors sigh with great relief when they see a shorter paper coming in, so don't feel obliged to do that. there you can mix and match. That's a sort of proportional distribution of words. If we see an introduction that's only very short or exceedingly long, we get, you know, some papers are all introduction and no data, you know, or all discussion and no data. You know, there's got to be a balance. So do try and look at the distribution. James Michener, who's a famous American author, was asked once, "Are you one of the world's greatest writers?" And he said, "No, but I'm one of the world's greatest rewriters." So I think you've got to expect to have revisions and to go over things and score them out and change them. Your first 5,000 word draft, or whatever length it is, can never be the finished product. And I reckon you may well write 20,000 words before you get the 5,000 words that you want. You do get better at this as you maybe get older or you get more experienced, but you've still got to, maybe you get worse as you get, I think I'm getting worse as I get older, but there's a point where I was getting better. But I think you've got to be prepared, even this precious writing you've done, you know, never throw it away, keep that draft, but you may have to change it, you know. And one of the ways to find out where you're going to change is to give it to other people to comment on. And of course, one of the people who comment on them, one of the groups of people who comment on them are editors and reviewers. So be prepared to make changes and to alter the drafts as you go through. Excuse me. Now, one of the things that... The most common reason for a paper being rejected by an editor-in-chief at the beginning of the process is not following the journal guidelines. The most common reason for papers being rejected thereafter, amongst a myriad of reasons to do with methodologies and designs and results and the significance or lack of significance or whatever, the most common reason is poor writing. And all editors will tell you this, and reviewers will tell you that as well. The paper's badly written, I can't make sense of it, or it's too wordy, or it's just, you know, it's just not well written. And we can't publish stuff that's not well written. I've said this 3 or 4 times this week already, you're much more likely to get poor research published that is well written than the most fantastic research that isn't well written. So you've got to pay attention to the writing. So the sort of things, this is from an excellent book by Helen Sword called, and I've forgotten the name of it, but anyway, it's about, you'll find Helen Sword, if you look it up on the internet, you'll find a book, it's about style and writing. And it's a very good book, it's actually based on an academic study, and she studied across lots of disciplines, including nursing and medicine, and she came to some conclusions. She gives some excellent examples in the book, which I'm not going to give here, of poor writing. She doesn't reference them specifically, but all the references she used are there, so you could find them, and there's some highly comical examples. But she came to the conclusion that, you know, the things we're looking for, and I don't have time to go into these in detail, are clarity, coherence, concision. You know, try to get sentences that are clear and concise. Try not to have too many words in them. Try to keep your sentences, this is in English, mixed or short, okay? Long sentences that go on forever with multiple clauses and ideas in them are just too confusing. So try to make them short or mix the length a little bit so the writing isn't long and boring and falling asleep like some people are in the audience, or very short staccato and hard to follow, but try and mix it. It's a subtle blend of shortness and long sentences. Plain English, try not to use big words. The first word that comes to your mind is the best word that you can possibly use, because that's usually the one that other people are using. You know? If you've written, the patients were transported by car to the hospital, don't say, automobile sounds better, because it doesn't. Okay? Car sounds fine. Precision, avoid vagueness and imprecision. I mean, we could give examples of that, but one of the ways of being imprecise is it would seem or it would appear that, you know, well, is it or isn't it? You know, don't couch what you're writing in imprecision. Just say it either is or it isn't. That's a famous trick of academic writers. Well, it would appear that this means, and they take a long time to get to the point, and when you get to the point, it's so surrounded by conditionals that actually you don't know what the point is. So try to be precise. Try not to be passive. Try to use active verbs. The dog bit the man instead of the man was bitten by the dog. It uses fewer words, it conveys the meaning better. We British are very poor at this. We tend to use a lot of passive writing and passive speech. Americans are much better at the active, I have to say. So we can learn, something we can learn from our American cousins. Tell a story. Now, again, this is far too long to go into here, but read it. And I work with a colleague called Ian Deary at the University of Edinburgh, and he's one of these kind of itch index of 84. He's one of the, you know, £30 million of research money, absolute megastar. When you give him a manuscript to read, he says, "What?" He asks, "What's the story here? What have we got?" You know, and he reads and he looks for the story, and that's what you want. It's a story. It's not just a set of sections. It's got to run from beginning to end and make sense. And the way that you can get things to tell a story is read them over and over yourself and give them to other people to read. Seeking some external view in the writing is the best way to get this. Try and tell a story, a narrative. So each bit is joined to the other bit sensibly. Try to use shorter words. Again, this is a miscellany, but we are very, very unimpressed by long words. This is just a few miscellaneous examples. I could never think, except within limits or within a space of time, I can never think of any other time when within should replace in. So you don't work within a hospital, you work in a hospital. You don't live within an apartment, you live in the apartment. Why do people write that? The patients were admitted within the hospital. You know, people, when they start writing academic writing, they think there's a style of academic writing. There isn't. There's only good writing and bad writing. Why do we say upon? I don't put the bottle of water upon the table, I put it on the table. Why do people write that? They do, because I have a search and destroy function that I use when I'm editing, and I find this sort of stuff all the time. And I can cut the manuscript down and make it much more readable in 5 minutes by doing this. Utilize, what a horrid word. Means absolutely nothing more than use, and it's got three syllables as opposed to one. Numerous, many. Demonstrate, show. Reside, live. Remainder, rest. You know what I mean? I could go on and on, but always think, can I use a much more concise word here that actually conveys the meaning just as well and doesn't tie people up in syllables? Big, large, voluminous, and endeavour, trial. You know what we're saying. Fewer words. This is the job of editing, and I'm going to show you an example of a quick bit of editing in a second. Maintaining, you know, rather than the maintenance of, developing rather than the development of. About, I mean, this in relation to, with regard to, in respect of, blah-de-blah, you know, it's just about something. You know, we tend to throw in these ridiculous phrases in academic writing. Editors don't like them. You'll never see about replaced with one of the other ones by anybody. This is what I was saying, it seems that is quite sufficient. Having said that, it seems that is a little bit imprecise as well. Several and some. This is the most commonly misused phrase in academic writing, a number of this, a number of that. Why do people say we don't say that? We don't go into a restaurant and say, I'd like a number of drinks, please. But we say it in writing. In order to do this, in order to do that, forget about in order. If something's true, to say it's true. In which can usually be missed out. The ways in which nurses do this, the ways nurses do this. Okay, there's lots of things you can search and destroy. If you're of the opinion of something, you just think it, and that's that. Okay, I'm being a little bit facetious. There's lots more examples. Again, you can have the slides and you can study these, but there are books that are available that will tell you a lot more about this than I can. In the time available. So, period of time. Okay? Time. Okay. So here's an example of a very poor piece of writing that I did and then edited. The way in which people write is of considerable interest, especially to nurses, because they're increasingly required to make and present arguments in writing to other people. 28 words. Here's what I would do with that as an editor. In which goes considerable, you know, superlatives can always go in academic writing, you don't need them. You don't need to emphasise, especially to nurses, it doesn't really matter. Increasingly, they're either required to do something or they're not. We all make these mistakes, I do it too, you know, but I edit them out. Okay, so we can get rid of a whole load of words there, and it becomes 18 words. The way people write is of interest to nurses, because they're required to present arguments in writing. I think you'll agree, no meaning lost there, and you could probably cut it down even further. It's not a competition. That's the sort of exercise you've got to go through after you've written something. Go through and take out these things. Learn when to let go. This is one of the biggest problems for certainly nursing academics. I can't speak for the medics and others in the audience, but I know that many of my nursing academics find it very hard to let go once they've written something. The point about writing for publication is letting go and sending it off for comments. So you've got to learn to let go. And I can't suggest any methods for doing this other than doing it. It's a bit like teaching somebody to swim by throwing them in the swimming pool. Not a good idea, but for this, just let go. Just don't worry. The criticism that comes back is not personal. And if you've written a single offer, nobody else is necessarily going to see it. You've got to develop a thick skin. Develop a skin like an elephant when you're a writer, because we editors have got thick skins as well. So you've got to be very insensitive. So finally, in the final couple of minutes, and maybe we'll have some questions, dealing with reviewers' comments, and I did go through this with some colleagues yesterday, but I want to go through it again. There's an excellent paper by Williams, The Golden Rules of Dealing with Editors' Comments, published in the American Journal of Dermatology. I do have it, and I should have maybe sent it to Neera. I'll try and remember to send these papers and send them out. But anyway, Williams has three rules of answering reviewers, and you will have to answer reviewers if you get into the writing and publishing industry. Answer completely, answer politely, and answer with evidence. Those are the three rules. And I've never not done that, a double negative. And every time I've done that, I've eventually had paper accepted if you do it that way. When I've got to that stage where I can answer the questions, I've been able to do it. So deal with every point. Sometimes you get a couple of lines of review, sometimes you get a full page. My record for two papers in a row was 10 pages of comments. They've all got to be dealt with, okay? And the thing to do is, if it's not given as point one, point two, point three, is to make it point one, point two, point three. Tabulate it yourself, put it on a table, put the page where the point was raised, put in how you've addressed it, and put in where you've addressed it, and if you're allowed to, because some publishers don't allow it, write it in red in the manuscript so the reviewer can clearly see where you've made the change. It also distracts them from reading the rest of the thing again, so it's a tactic to get them to. Make a list of points even if you're not presented with it. Answer politely. Don't start with things like, you know, you completely disagree with the comments of the reviewers, or who on earth are you reviewers. If you don't agree with the reviewers, you have to thank them for considering the paper, thanking them for the comments. But we would like to point out that there's an alternative view, or we can actually refute that point as follows. Which brings me on to the third point, answer with evidence. So if you disagree, provide a reference, provide the facts, provide a web page, or whatever. And don't just deal with the reviewer if it's a serious point that may be important to address in the paper. Include that point in the paper as well, if necessary, because they've clearly not seen it there. So if you make a point, like I did in a paper once, that Cronbach's alpha is virtually a useless measure of reliability of questionnaires, which it is, by the way, somebody disagreed intensely. And of course, I haven't supported that point at all. I didn't say it quite like that. I said it was a doubtful measure because it's a biased measure. And so I just wrote that back into the paper, answered politely, put the references of it, so about half a dozen, but that point one paper accepted and published. Well, I think I've managed to take us around 45 minutes on the dot, Richard, so thanks very much, everybody, for listening. I've advertised this book three times so far, but there's a book edited by me. I've got six grandchildren who need Christmas presents, so it's not very expensive, so if you go online and buy that, then I'll be very happy, and so will they. Thanks very much.